It's a funny place to be, stuck in a seemingly mundane world with an inner knowing that the universe is so much more than our mortal minds can comprehend. Yet we all have the capacity to know peace and our oneness with the wholeness of life. And through these interviews, discussions, and reflections, it is my intention to share this possibility. I'm Ryan Kurzak, and this is the Kriya Yoga Podcast.
3, 2, 1. So welcome everybody back to the Kriya Yoga Podcast. I'm here with another very special guest, dear spiritual friend of mine, Chris Sartain, who's also a student of Roy Eugene Davis. He has been ordained by Mr. Davis and authorized to teach Kriya Yoga. He's originally from the U.S., but moved to Chile about 6 years ago, and he runs a yoga school there with his wife, and the name of that school is Vinyasa Yoga Chile, and this is located in Patagonia, southern Chile. Chris, along with being a yoga school administrator and teacher, Kriya Yoga practitioner, he's also an author, and he's written several books, one of them being The Sacred Science of Yoga and the Five Koshas, another, Spiritually Mature Yoga, and his most recent publication, as close to 2019 as possible, is Kriya Yoga Realizations. So today, we're going to be talking about particular sutras from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali and how they relate to our spiritual practice and how they can help us to grow more inwardly, more profoundly into self-realization. So thank you for being here with me today, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ryan. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so you've been down in Chile for about 6 years now, right?
Yes, that's about right. 5.5 years, 6 years, something like that.
And how long have you had the yoga school running down there?
We've been offering yoga teacher trainings for about 4 years, although we had the school previously in Atlanta for several years, and also in Colorado, where we lived for a couple of years before moving here. And we've been operating here for about 4 years, and we offer 200 hour and 500 hour yoga teacher trainings all over Chile and various different parts of Chile and also Argentina. And we also recently, I don't want to say finished construction because it's really a work in progress, but we have a yoga and meditation retreat center in southern Chile in the Patagonia region that we also run now.
Well, I remember the video. I don't know if you sent it around or if you sent it to me or if I just stumbled upon it, but you gave a video tour of the area you're in. It looked like you're by a volcano. How far away is that?
Far enough to create enough fear to keep you honest, you know. it's about 30 miles. It looks closer than it actually is. It's like the rear view mirror effect, you know.
Right.
But yeah, it's about 30 miles away, so it is active. People don't really, I mean, I've seen it erupt. I've seen lava spew out of it from our from our vantage point at our property, but it's not dangerous, but it is active. We're surrounded by volcanoes there. It's a very active area as far as geothermal activity. Because of that, there are a plethora of hot springs. We probably have about 30 hot springs within an hour's drive of where we are. We have one very close that we can walk to.
All right.
Just amazing. So if people enjoy hot springs, it's kind of a hot spring paradise there.
Well, it looks like a really beautiful area. So you've got the yoga school going, and what is the what is it like there in regards to interest in meditation? Is that growing there? Is it prevalent? What's it like in your area?
That's a good question. It's interesting, you know, in the United States, well, of course, Yogananda arrived in 1920, and we can sort of pinpoint that year as sort of the beginning of interest in meditation and yoga in the United States. But here in Chile, gosh, it probably, only has about 30 years since maybe 1990-ish, I want to say. So it's something relatively new here.
Right. Still.
And so interest has been increasing recently, but people still don't have a very good grasp of what meditation is. Well, gosh, this we could probably say the same in most countries.
Right.
But here, meditation is still associated with relaxation exercises or guided visualizations or maybe breathing techniques or affirmations or sound therapy, sound healing, sound meditations, that sort of thing. So it's difficult for me to explain to people that none of that is actually meditation. And that's been hard for me. The most difficult challenge I've faced is educating people about what meditation really is, and that it's not a technique or a set of techniques. But anyway, so there's growing interest here.
Yeah, so you're helping to lead the charge in the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, there's a lot of us.
Yeah, well, that's
there's
good.
There's a lot of people. Yeah, there's a lot of people that are teaching meditation. We have Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist groups here, Zen Buddhist groups from Japan also, in Chile, and a good number of yogis that have studied in India and have studied with some of the great masters. Not many, but there's a few of us here that are, I guess you could say, leading the charge.
Right.
But certainly interest has been increasing steadily, I think, over the years. But again, it's something relatively new here. And it's a very Catholic country. So it's a very sort of conservative Catholic country. And that's been interesting to navigate as well.
Right, right. Well, you know, considering that, discussing the idea of what meditation is, in one of the sutras or two of the sutras that you picked, when we were talking about doing this podcast, I said, well, let's think about six sutras from the Yoga Sutras that could really help people understand what this was all about. And the first one, which is at the very beginning of the Yoga Sutras, Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha, that in a nutshell encompasses the whole process. So can you describe that to us, what your understanding of that is, and how an understanding of that particular sutra can help people recognize what true meditation is?
Sure. Perhaps it would be useful to define each term separately, and then I'll give sort of a synopsis of what the entire verse means.
Yeah.
So in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, yoga and samadhi are synonymous, so they have the same meaning, and both roughly mean union or divine union or union with the individual, union of the individual consciousness with the supreme consciousness, something like that. Chitta is typically translated as mind. However, I'm not too crazy about that translation. I'll return to that in a second. Vritti has various translations, fluctuations, movements, vibrations, which I like, all of those. However, when we are meditating, when we are in the act of meditation, vrittis are distractions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then nirodha means to cease or to stop or to pacify. So chitta is a little bit problematic, because in my experience with meditation, it is possible to have vrittis or to experience vrittis that are not exclusively mental.
Right.
In other words, if my shoulder hurts or my back is sore or I have a little bit of a headache or something like that, these are physical vrittis that I'm experiencing. Likewise, if I experience emotions or energies, these can also be distractions, and these are not mental distractions. Mm-hmm. These are happening in my pranamaya kosha or my energetic layer. So when we talk about chitta, I prefer to say that the chitta is our entire being.
Right.
So in other words, And other people have translated it as the field of awareness, which is also pretty good, but it's still somewhat lacking. So I prefer to think of chitta as our entire being, all five layers of our being. You mentioned earlier that one of my books is about the five koshas. And so I'm always thinking in terms of the koshas, and the five kosha means layer or sheath.
Right.
And these are five layers that cover up our Atman or soul. And so I think of the chitta as encompassing all five of those layers. So in other words, yoga chitta vritti nirodha altogether basically means yoga or samadhi happens or occurs when there are no fluctuations or movements or vibrations or distractions in our being.
Mm-hmm.
And I always like to add a word to this definition. I like to say yoga or samadhi can occur when there are no fluctuations in our being. In other words, in my experience, there's no guarantee of this experience of samadhi or divine union. There is an element of grace from the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, that needs to also occur mm-hmm. in order for us to have this deep and profound experience of divine union and oneness consciousness. So in other words, in my experience, it is a combination of our own meditative efforts, but also with a little sprinkling of divine grace.
Right. I'm not going to argue with that, but two points I'm curious about to clarify is, so when you're describing chitta as being, well, our being, mm-hmm. and again, you're probably implying this, I don't know, but for the people who are listening, is that if we're looking at it as the five layers, these are the layers where experience is it the level of being where experience occurs? Because like our whole being, there's actually, you know, that part of us which, you know, is not bound by experience or something that can be defined. So when you're using that word chitta, is that how you're considering it?
Yeah, great question. So we say that the koshas, and it's interesting that each kosha, anamaya kosha, pranamaya, manomaya, vijnanamaya, anandamaya, all end in the word maya.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
which means illusion.
Uh-huh.
And it is vibratory. So all five of the koshas vibrate, and they're vibratory phenomenon. And so the Atman, or the soul, does not vibrate. It has no vibration. And so it just observes in tranquil, perfect peace.
Right.
And so, yes, to answer your question, yes, the chitta
is the observable.
Is the observable, yeah, the experiential part of our being. And so, you know, if you look at sort of the philosophy of qualified Advaita Vedanta, there's this notion that there is oneness, but this oneness has two parts, which,
right.
you know, mentally, intellectually, we is impossible to comprehend. How can one thing have two?
Right.
But essentially, there is the part of God that does not vibrate, which is known as Shiva, and the part of God that does vibrate, the feminine aspect, which is known as Shakti.
Mm-hmm.
But so chitta, we could say, is the Shakti, the part of us that vibrates, that is comprised of five koshas. And so
mm-hmm.
when we calm and pacify these vibrations that are constantly occurring in our being, we have a much better opportunity to experience that part of us which does not vibrate.
Right,
which is the
right.
soul, the Atman, the divine.
Mm-hmm. And the other aspect that you were discussing about this idea of you can experience this oneness when these things are calmed or pacified or not vibrating anymore. And the only thing that makes me wonder about is, you know, many people have an idea of what a oneness experience is like. And so I completely agree that there is an aspect of it where grace is necessary and, you know, we can't control it. We can't force it to happen. But then I wonder at times, if someone is sitting in meditation and everything is still and calm, yet there is no sense of oneness, or what we would typically consider to be kind of like that sensationalized experience of samadhi, there is just simply stillness. I mean, that is also enough though, right? That is also useful in the process.
Extremely useful. And in these elevated states of super consciousness, many good things happen.
Right. and we don't always know what they are.
Right. Yes. We burn through karma. We eliminate subconscious tendencies, and we change the structure, the literal physical structure of the brain via neuroplasticity. So we increase the size and the strength of the frontal lobes, which are associated with concentration, creativity, discernment, self-control, discipline, all good things for a yogi to have.
Right.
And we begin to turn off the reptilian brain that is more associated with the lower chakras and base instincts and that sort of thing. And also during these elevated superconscious states, we can begin to see an inner light. We can hear the om vibration. Sometimes the brain will begin to produce soma, which is this nectar that is produced in advanced meditators in the brain that converts into amrita or ambrosia in the body. So many, many good things occur in these elevated superconscious states of stillness. But you ask the question, is it enough? So my question to you would be, enough for what?
Well, the reason I ask that is because oftentimes when I'm interacting with people who are meditating, they may experience this point of stillness, but because it's not some kind of mind-blowing samadhi like Yogananda would describe, they think that either they're failing, or they think that well, obviously it's not working. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. I deal with the same thing with my meditation students. I always tell them, look, samadhi, you have to be realistic. You know, you have to, sometimes I think of my role in some of these things is like, have you ever seen that show Mythbusters?
Yes.
Yeah. So right. I kind of think of myself as like this, is a myth buster sometimes. Samadhi is very rare. Mm-hmm. Like very few people experience samadhi, and there are various levels of samadhi. We should go ahead and say that. I mean, it's not one thing, you know. There's for example, Savikalpa samadhi, Nirvikalpa samadhi, Kalvaya, and all this. Okay, so there's various levels or stages of samadhi that one can experience. However, all of those stages are rare. They're very rare experiences for meditators. Even people that have been meditating for many years, I talk to people sometimes that say, I've been meditating for 40 years. I've never had a single experience of samadhi. And you know what? I have the utmost respect for those people.
Because they're still doing it.
Yeah. They have the discipline and they're still spiritually hungry.
Right.
You know, and then I talk to other people who meditate for a few months and maybe have some profound experience, and they think they've got it all figured out, and they stop meditating, and then they revert back to old habits and old patterns and things like that. So what's more useful, you know, right. the mind-blowing samadhi experience early on, mm-hmm. or the person who is experiencing elevated superconscious states on an almost daily basis for 40 years? Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know the answer to that. It's I will say this though, it's far more complicated than people think.
Yes.
This whole process.
Right. Well, that leads, I think, into the next sutra that you had chosen, which is from chapter one, sutra 21 of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, where it says, for one whose progress is fast and whose progress is intensive, samadhi is near. And I've been drawn to the sutra a lot too, because I think what people really need to kind of get a sense of is what that word intensive means, right? Mm. So from your perspective, you know, you chose this sutra. What about this sutra? What about the sutra really speaks to you about what is required for this meditation process in Kriya Yoga?
Okay, well, intensive for me implies that one is spiritually hungry. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be a certain spiritual appetite, almost a desperation. you know, the sages say there are typically two ways that one is led to meditation or the spiritual path, either a profound longing for the divine, mm-hmm. or really intense suffering. And I have to say that my path was probably a mixture, sort of a combination of both. But, and I think it probably is for most people, so I don't necessarily think it's one or the other. Right. However, I will say that intense suffering is really useful.
Yes.
Really useful for someone on a spiritual path. It's very utilitarian suffering. And so, because it creates a spiritual hunger, you wish to escape your suffering, which, and I have to qualify this, that's not a very good motivation.
Right.
To tell you the truth, because it's a very selfish motivation, but we discover that later on typically. So if that is the catalyst for someone to begin meditating, that's okay. That's perfectly fine. However, you know, further along the way, you realize, oh, well, that's actually a very sort of selfish motivation. But anyway, so intensive to me means that you're spiritually hungry and you're willing to commit to the discipline necessary to attain your spiritual goals. Mm. And you can get down into sadhana, you know, as far as like the duration of your sadhana. And so Yogananda used to talk about this. Mr. Davis used to talk about this. I've heard you discuss this. And so, you know, you can have like sort of a beginner's level and an intermediate level and an advanced level of sadhana. And typically we could say, well, maybe a beginner's level is 20 minutes a day of meditation. Intermediate might be, I don't know, 35, 40 minutes. And then an advanced meditator might be meditating for an hour or more at a time. And then you can even say, well, maybe once a day isn't enough. Maybe once a day is not intensive, actually. Mm-hmm. And we need to be meditating two or three times a day, actually,
right.
To really purify all this stuff that needs to get purified. And to calm all the vrittis, to minimize all the vrittis so that we can probe the deeper layers of our being.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you balance that with, I remember one time when I was first getting involved in Kriya Yoga, and it was probably, I don't know, 2 years in, you know, you read all these stories in autobiography of a yogi of people meditating, you know, 6-8 hours at a time all night long. And I used to think, oh, I have to do that. You know, if I'm not doing that, then I'm really not practicing intensive. And I remember it would give me headaches and I wouldn't be able to sleep. And Mr. Davis said to me, you need to meditate for shorter periods of time and not give yourself a headache.
Yeah.
So where's that balance between, you know, that drive, but also recognizing, you know, we all might, you know, when I first got started, I could barely meditate for longer than 20 minutes. But after 20 years, well, a couple hours is really nothing. So how does one that's just getting into it, how do they balance that desire with the realistic of kind of growing into a more intensive practice?
Well, I probably have a fairly extreme take on it. I think one should be...
You seem like an extreme guy.
But anyway, I think one should be ready and willing to sacrifice it all for God. However, in a more practical sense, because we work with people that live in, you know, the real world and have duties, responsibilities, family, career, children, etc. So we have to be more practical about this. And what I typically recommend to people is meditating twice a day. And I usually start them off with 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening. Seems like a pretty good number. And a lot of the studies, you know, the neurological studies show that we need to meditate for a minimum of 15 minutes to really activate the parts of the brain that we need to activate and deactivate the parts of the brain that we need to deactivate and so on and so forth. It takes about 15 minutes typically to get to that stage. So 20 minutes seems to be a pretty good number. And so, yeah, I typically recommend that folks meditate 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening, and go about their day and go about their normal interactions and activities and whatnot. But if somebody's really, really hungry and really wants to go for it, I don't see any problem with going to live in an ashram or monastery or whatever. I mean, people do that. People do that every day, all the time. It's in the Western world. Unfortunately, there's still a little bit of a stigma associated with people that go off to live in a monastery or an ashram, like they are lazy somehow.
Right.
And so it's associated with laziness. Oh, this guy, he just goes and sits around all day and he doesn't work. He's not a productive member of society.
Uh-huh.
That sort of thing. But I see no problem with going off to live in a monastery or an ashram if you feel called to do so. Why not?
Well, that's essentially what you've done, right? Moving down to Chile with your yurt and your mountains, right? Or no?
We actually work a lot.
I didn't mean to say you were lazy.
Oh, no, no. In some senses, I definitely am. But no, we actually work a lot more than I would like. My wife's a real go-getter.
Yeah.
And she, you know, if you know anything about Ayurveda, she is full on pitta. And, pitta. So like she really loves to work. She's a little bit of a workaholic, which is good for me, because it motivates me to work more. And so we do end up working a lot, but I think in the next few years, things will slow down. I have to say though, that when I first met Mr. Davis, I was a school teacher. And I had my summers off, so I would have about 2.5 months of every year off, free, you know, vacation time.
Right.
And Mr. Davis, you know, at CSA, they would offer several. Sorry, my phone's ringing.
It's okay.
They would offer several meditation retreats every summer. And so for a few summers there, it was just like, okay, well, instead of going to the beach or the mountains or whatever, traveling, I'm just going to go to all these meditation retreats, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I would spend, you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks out of every summer or whatever it was in retreat. And so I highly recommend meditation retreats, even for people that have a lot of responsibilities and career and that sort of thing. That's all well and good, but you should take the time out each year to experience a retreat, because during a retreat, your practice can become much more intensive, going back to that word.
Right.
And you have the time to really dive deep and to really probe the deeper layers of your being without so many distractions around. And the great thing about CSA that I used to love, I don't know if it's still this way, but there used to be no cell phone signal there.
Yeah, it's very spotty. So yes, it's hard to get a cell phone signal. That is for sure.
Oh, it was wonderful, you know, because you could just totally disconnect from all of that. That's a problem I'm seeing a lot now is everybody's just on their devices all day long. And so they think they don't have time to meditate, but you know, if you put down that phone for a little while each day, I think you would find you have an inordinate amount of time for meditation.
Right. Yeah, well, there are numerous what do you call them, luxuries, you know, technological luxuries that we have, that they actually open up so much time for us that if we would really recognize that, I mean, we could have an hour, 2 hours a day just to sit and, you know, read the Bhagavad Gita, or, you know, read a book on meditation, or to meditate more. I mean, it's there. It's just kind of trying to get people away from addiction to having their senses stimulated all the time.
Yes. Exactly.
But that's also the good thing about the retreats, as you're mentioning, is that if you do it for long enough, you know, I think a week can be good, or longer is even better. That gives you some time to kind of go through the withdrawal of all the stimulation that you did have, right? Because, yes, you know, a lot of people, even when they meditate, when they sit down to meditate, they're spending the first, you know, 10 to 15 minutes just letting go of all the things that are going on in their life. And it's once they get to that 15-minute, 20-minute mark that, if they're doing it well, that it's then they actually start to experience that sort of tranquility of the process. So with meditation, with retreats, you know, while you don't want to give yourself a headache or get yourself fired from your job, you do want to do enough such that you're able to access that state. And I think that takes time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, time. Yeah, that's another myth, you know, that there's a lot of teachers out there, gurus, that say you don't even need to meditate, and that we shouldn't think in terms of time.
Right.
And it's, you don't need to practice over a long period of time to attain enlightenment or elevated states of consciousness, which maybe that, and that is certainly true for some rare souls, you know.
Yeah, for two of them.
Yeah, right. Like Ramana Maharishi, a couple others, right? However, for the rest of us, yeah, it's necessary to practice, and it does take time, because we, once you begin to understand neuroplasticity and the changes in the brain and nervous system that need to occur in order to elevate your consciousness to certain stages of super consciousness and samadhi, you realize, oh, well, these changes, physiological changes, take time. You know, one of the things I love to tell my students is that enlightenment is a physiological process. And you just see their eyes sort of glaze over, and like this look of shock and like bewilderment on their faces. How could enlightenment be because we always think of it as something energetic, you know, kundalini, chakras, nadis, blah, blah, blah. But really, it, in large part, I'll say, not completely, in large part, it is a physiological process that has to occur.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a very good point. And you know, even Ramana Maharshi, who did have an early childhood awakening experience, you know, when you read his talks, the talks with Ramana Maharshi, you know, he doesn't just tell people, hey, you know, you don't need to do anything. If someone needs to practice a mantra, if someone needs some kind of supportive process, you know, he had the sense enough to say, all right, well, right now you might not be able to recognize the truth of your nature, so it's perfectly okay for you to go ahead and do this mantra with devotion, and do your meditation practice with devotion to realize, to become aware of that. And you know, a lot of the people that I've seen, you know, in the current spiritual economy that seem to promote just be there now and that's all you right. need, you know, they have a profound experience, and then that seems to be all that happens. And then that's what they're sharing. And happily, I do have to say, there was at least one teacher that I was aware of that I'd met in Asheville a few times, that he was a young guy. And of course he had some experience and was running around talking nonsense and mm-hmm. acting like you don't have to do anything to experience it, and give me your money while you're at it and I'll be happy. but I actually saw one of his talks, I don't know why I clicked on it, just to see what he was talking about now. And he was now saying, oh, well, practice can actually be good for you. So I thought to myself, finally. So, you know, as you describe, you know, time, it's not necessarily that we want to get over fixated on time. I think it's more just the recognition that, you know, we are just like plants and animals and physical things. We are growing and we are maturing and we are growing through this human experience, and that might take time, and it's okay to do things that help to support that along the way, just like maybe eating more fruits and vegetables can help to support you to be as healthy as you possibly can be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, for sure. Anyway, so looking at, you know, the list of sutras that we have here, the next one you picked, I particularly like this one as well. It's Sutra 28, where you say, one should vocally and mentally chant Om, or Patanjali says, one should vocally and mentally chant Om, attentively listen to it, meditatively contemplate it, comprehend its real nature and identify with it. And we talked about in meditation how once you start to access those states of clarity and stillness, it is possible to see an inner light in the frontal regions of the brain, the spiritual eye center, as it's called. It's possible to hear that Om vibration, which again, one of my first experiences with that was after Kriya initiation, it's CSA, just the stillness. The stillness that happened after that allowed this Om vibration to come forward. So with this sutra, there's so much that can be said about, you know, Lahiri Mahasaya, he talks about how the Omkar Kriya, or learning to hear the Om vibration, he describes the body itself as a manifestation of Om, in such that even by paying attention to the body and the vibration in the body, that can lead to this understanding, this feeling of Om. So with this amazingly, what I consider to be complex and deep sutra, how does it speak to you, and what would you like, you know, people who are practicing meditation and Kriya to understand about the sutra, such that they can process the path with more grace?
Sure. Well, many of the ancient yogic texts speak of the Om technique of meditation, which they refer to as Nada Yoga, usually, or sometimes Shabda Yoga, as the highest technique of Dharana. Dharana is concentration. It's the sixth step in the eight steps of Patanjali. And it's a preliminary step before we enter into Jhana, which is superconscious meditation, which is a thought-free, clear state, mostly thought-free, typically. And so most of the texts describe Nada Yoga or Shabda Yoga as the highest, most advanced technique of Dharana or concentration that we can use to concentrate and focus the mind. And Om is essentially the substratum of all of manifestation, even more subtle than the Anandamaya kosha. So we have these five koshas. Each kosha is less and less dense, has a less dense frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But even below Anandamaya kosha, which is the least dense of all the layers of our being, exists the Om vibration. So it's the most subtle vibratory phenomenon in the universe. And it's, I had a great meditation teacher, Graham Fowler, who I took a course on Shabda Yoga with some years ago. And he told me, he was a student of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he told me that the Om vibration is the closest we can get to God within the manifest realm. So I loved the way he described it. And so essentially, we can use this technique of Nada Yoga or Shabda Yoga or Omkar Kriya in the Kriya tradition to focus our attention and awareness on a subtle vibration occurring in and around the head. We start off with that. Usually it's a physical sound, the sound of electrical signals in the brain or the flow of blood in the head and brain. And we can listen, we can actually hear that. And so we completely focus our attention, unite our attention fully with that sound. And then after usually a few minutes, we begin to search for an even more subtle sound frequency, and so on and so forth for the entire duration of our meditation, so that we're constantly searching for a deeper layer or a more subtle and refined frequency or vibration, and eventually we can hear or experience is probably a better word, experience the subtle vibration of Om and unite our attention fully with that. And it's just a wonderful technique to use when we're meditating. It's actually the primary technique that I now teach. I teach the Kriya techniques, but then, you know, after you perform the pranayama techniques, I now primarily teach Shabda Yoga or Omkar. And we actually use noise-canceling headphones with my students so that they can really hear the subtle and refined frequencies more clearly. Mm-hmm. And so, or you can use earplugs, headphones, whatever you need, but it's a really highly effective technique.
Right. So, you know, there's a few things I'm curious about that. You know, in this particular sutra, it talks about vocally chanting Om and mentally chanting Om. What role does that play related to actually being able to have the experience to listen, to hear Om, the Om vibration?
Well, Sanskrit chanting in general is very useful to do because it quiets and stills the mind. These Sanskrit syllables have a very specific effect on our being, on all the layers of our being. And whenever we do chant Om or whatever Sanskrit mantra, it's very important to try and feel our entire body vibrating, and especially the spine and the vertebrae, because we have our Sushumna Nadi along the physical spine. It's sort of our astral spine, if you want to think of it that way. And it connects all of the chakras. And in the yoga tradition, we say that we have our karma in the chakras. Mm-hmm. So in other words, we carry our baggage within the chakras. And so if we can vibrate the spine and vibrate the Sushumna Nadi, we can actually clean and purify the chakras. You can think of like a guitar string that is dusty, and this guitar string is full of dust. And when you pluck it and vibrate the string, all of the dust flies off, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we clean the guitar string? We vibrate the guitar string so that all of the dust flies away. Well, we can think of that same analogy for the physical spine, the astral spine, so that when we chant Sanskrit mantras, especially Om, we want to ideally feel our body vibrating and the spine vibrating so that we can purify and clear some of the karma and samskaras that is present within the chakras. So it's a great preliminary kriya or action that we can do to prepare for meditation.
Right. And the use of the kriya pranayama itself, you know, that helps to kind of cast off this dust on the string, if you will. Yes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why doing the Kriya Pranayama, as well as doing Jyoti Mudra, those are really wonderful ways of kind of internalizing attention such that you're able to hear the Om vibration more clearly, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Kriya Pranayama, where we move the prana through the Sushumna Nadi with the breath, is also very purifying and mm-hmm. cleansing for karma. Samskaras is probably even more so than chanting Om or chanting in general. The problem with Kriya Pranayama, it's not a problem, I shouldn't say that. The issue with Kriya Pranayama is that oftentimes it requires several months of constant disciplined practice to open the Sushumna Nadi. And I think that's one of the reasons that many people who are initiated into Kriya do not continue with the practice, because they are unable to feel the effects, the energetic effects of Kriya Pranayama within their Sushumna Nadi, because the Sushumna Nadi is typically closed in most people, the vast majority. And so what most people don't understand is that typically it requires months of Kriya Pranayama practice to actually begin to open the Sushumna Nadi and to literally increase the size and circumference and diameter of the Sushumna Nadi so that prana can more easily flow up to the higher chakras.
And so by kind of focusing on chanting Om and contemplating Om, that's also a supplementary technique to just assist that process to help bring people's attention to the areas that need worked on.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. And so I'm assuming you put that towards the end of your, when you recommend meditation, you tend to put that towards the end of the meditation procedure, or where does that fit in regards to, say, like a schedule or a routine?
That's a great question. A lot of people prefer to chant before they meditate. I've always preferred to chant after. I don't know why, but yeah. I typically chant. I have a chanting practice that I do after I finish meditating at the very end of my session in my sadhana, because I find that after I meditate, I'm far more sensitive to subtle energies and frequencies. Mm. And so I can feel the effects of the mantras and the chanting far more after I meditate. But there are other people that love to chant before they meditate because it calms the mind and gets them in a more devotional state. So I think people just need to experiment. There's no one size fits all sadhana, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, you bring up a good point there. And I think this is something that a lot of people either mistake or look over, or just don't believe that they have the capacity to, you know, make a decision on their own. And that is, you know, with this whole process, it needs to be something that you can get into, that you can participate in, that you can feel, that you can have a response from. And, you know, whereas one person learning a musical instrument might need to have a practice schedule that's different than another's, you know, it's okay if you find that chanting after you meditate really helps bring it home for you, you know, or if doing alternate nostril breathing before you meditate, that's a wonderful way to calm the mind. You know, there are certain procedures, obviously, that we follow, but, you know, we are all individuals. And what you've just illustrated is that we need to pay attention to how do we respond to the practices and trust that we can, as long as we're not completely rearranging everything, we can actually make choices within our own practice such that our meditations have a greater effect and a greater impact in the time that we have to, you know, to practice them.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So when we think about this idea of Om being the, you mentioned that Om being the aspect of the divine as close to the idea of pure divinity or I'm not sure exactly the word you use, but the Om vibration allows us to experience that this side of manifestation, as in, you know, the rise and fall of things. And, you know, looking at that next sutra, which the primary cause of suffering is a mistaken self-identity. And we are jumping from chapter one all the way up to chapter two. However, I think that by contemplating Om, you know, as we get closer to that understanding of the wholeness of life, God, divinity, we tend to not have such a mistaken sense of self-identity. You know, we tend to see other people as manifestations of ourselves. So we tend to treat them better. We tend to understand that we are connected to everything on the planet. And so we tend to treat the planet better. this idea, the primary cause of suffering is mistaken self-identity. How do we take something like this esoteric principle of contemplating the Om vibration and translate it into maybe more practical, down-to-earth, everyday living approach to recognizing, well, what am I? You know, how do we make this jump from these esoteric things to not having a mistaken sense of self-identity while we are playing the role that we're meant to play in this world? Yeah, I think that's what I mean to ask.
Geez, if I had an answer to that, man, I think I'd have it all figured out. You know? that's what I struggle with as far as like down to earth practical application. That might be my challenge for this incarnation. But
right.
Although I do better than I used to. But yeah, so I love the question. Essentially, we use whatever technique we need to get us to a stage of super consciousness. So maybe you like to listen to Om, maybe you like to repeat a mantra, maybe you just like to observe the breath, and maybe you visualize a sacred form or yantra. These are all different techniques of dharana that we can implement to get us to jhana, which is the super conscious meditative state or transcendental meditative state. Mm-hmm. And so in this super conscious state, we experience ourselves as the observer or witness without anything to observe. So we are the observer without its observations. And we can experience that, if we can observe the mind, we can observe the contents of the mind, we can observe the body, we can observe the personality, and so on and so forth. Obviously, we are not any of these things that we observe. We are the observer, in fact. And what is this observer? Supreme consciousness, or what Patanjali describes or defines as unbounded consciousness, which I love. And so this verse says the primary cause of suffering is a mistaken sense of self-identity. In other words, you suffer because you are identified with the sufferer. Mm. You identify with the sufferer because of this great spell of Maya. And so when you are identified with that which suffers, you will suffer. And so what we have to realize, and we begin to realize in superconscious states, even more so in samadhi, is that we are not that which suffers. We are not the thing that suffers. We are the thing that observes the thing that suffers. Mm-hmm. And so when we begin to unify our attention and awareness more and more day by day, with the observer and the witness, supreme unbounded consciousness, we can observe the person that is suffering objectively, without reaction, without participation, without identification, without judgment, in a very calm, tranquil, objective manner. And so for me, that's what this verse signifies. As far as then how do we bring that back into the world, and how do we live as that observer? Well, that's the real trick, isn't it?
Right.
Practicing what the Buddhists refer to as mindfulness, although I don't particularly care for that term as much. I prefer like objective observation instead of mindfulness. But how do we live from this super conscious state of objective observation within the world and within our day-to-day activities and social interactions and so on and so forth? That's where the spiritual path gets really fun and really challenging. And I'm still trying to figure that all out, as we all are, I guess.
Well, what's the difficulty then? I mean, that's always the thing I'm curious about, because, you know, we read these texts on spiritual topics. We have teachers telling us different things, and we have our own practice. You know, I'm always curious you know, we're told, and you even mentioned early on, that we need to kind of like sacrifice it all or give it all up, you know, for this ideal experience to dawn or realization to dawn. But then we get to the point where there's a sutra like this where it says the primary cause of suffering is a mistaken sense of self-identity, which in a way kind of implies, well, if I'm living my life and I'm in this world and I'm not going to mistake myself as just this limited, you know, Ryan personality body, and a situation arises where I can make a choice that's maybe, and this might be maybe an oversimplification, but I can make a choice that is the right choice, such as, you know, someone needs something from me, and knowing that I am I'm not just this limited personality body that, hey, I can provide that, or I can be a vehicle vessel through which that can be realized, or I can mistake myself and say, well, you know what, that's really not going to help this little Ryan out very much, so I'm not going to do that. But I'm a yogi, and I'll figure it out eventually. So
Mr. Davis always said that, you know, that we would, when we are super conscious, when we're more or less self-realized, we always do whatever is appropriate in every moment of every day.
Right.
And that has certainly been my experience when I'm in a good place spiritually. I just act appropriately. In other words, there is no choice.
Right.
However, when I'm more trapped inside this Chris thing, I'm always choosing. and I'm not always acting appropriately.
I like that. Sure.
And so when we are in this sort of elevated state from this vantage point of the self, with a capital S self, we tend to just act appropriately, and there's really no choice. We don't have to choose anything. It's a choiceless existence. Mm-hmm. However, once we become identified again with our limited, temporary, fleeting, transient self, we tend to get trapped in the mind, which mm-hmm. is the realm of choices,
right,
and decisions, and the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other, you know. However, when we're in a really good place spiritually, those choices don't really exist. It's a choiceless existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something to contemplate.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's a good, I like the way you put that, that there is no choice. And the reason I'm hesitating here is because this can go in so many different philosophical directions. And I know, you know, oftentimes when people listen to talks like this or discussions like this, that what comes up is this difficulty with, sort of like fate and free will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that brings up all kinds of things. So when we practice our meditation and when we do our kriya practice, and as realizations come and as we become clearer, it sounds to me like what you're saying, and this kind of has been my experience too, is that when life is happening, we're not necessarily overthinking it.
Exactly. Well, there's no need.
Right.
Because you're living from a place of divine inspiration. In other words, you're just sort of a pure channel. Well, channel is not a great word. Conduit, let's say. You're a pure conduit for that divine presence in the world.
Right.
So there's no choices to be made. It's automatic. Choices and decisions occur when we're not in that space, and when we're not flowing, when we're not in the flow. You know, I studied Eastern religions in college, and my favorite text, or two of my favorite texts at that time, were the Tao Te Ching and Zhuangzi, these Taoist texts. Mm-hmm. And the Tao is, you know, is sort of translated as the flow, you know, and or the way, you know.
Right.
And so their whole philosophy is just like getting yourself, lowercase s, self, out of the way so that you can just flow.
Right.
There's flow. There's Tao. There's flow, you know. And I'm sure as a musician, you find this too, when especially when you're improvising, when you're mm-hmm. soloing or playing lead. I find that once I get my mind out of the way, once I get Chris totally out of the way, my solos are so much better. And
right.
my improvisations are so much clearer and juicier and more creative.
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up some very good points, especially, we'll start with the one about music. What I've been thinking about, again, why I hesitate around this kind of topic is because, you know, over the years, talking to people who are just getting in meditation or studying spirituality, there is a lot of anxiety about doing the right thing. And, you know, if we start saying things like, well, you just have to be in the flow. And if someone who isn't quite disciplined already decides they're going to be in the flow, oftentimes they do a lot of stupid shit.
Sure.
And what I want to say first is that...
Okay, so the flow that you're describing is what I would call sort of sleepwalking autopilot flow.
Okay.
You know, and so maybe we can distinguish between this sort of like autopilot ego flow, you know, versus a sort of higher state flow. Maybe. I'm not sure if that's what you're describing. Maybe you can...
Well, yeah. I mean, there's two lines of thought that I'm trying to pull together here. And one, we'll use the musician idea first. You know, in order to play a solo, you have to think about music first, meaning you have to actually learn to play your instrument.
Yes.
Then you can solo and you can turn off your mind and it can just come out beautifully. So the reason I like that example is because for individuals who are worried about doing the right thing or are worried about, oh my goodness, you mean I just have to, what if I surrender, everything will fall apart. Well, what I would say is no. Learn your scales, learn your techniques first, read the Yoga Sutras, contemplate truthfulness, non-possessiveness, brahmacharya, like do that, because that's like learning that the principles of what's going to lead to the flow. And then as a person does that, as they start to practice meditation, then they start to have moments of where they recognize, oh, things are just flowing. And of course, they're going to go back into states of, oh, well, how do I repeat that? My mind is now trying to figure all this out. Well, as long as you keep moving forward with that, as long as you keep improving upon the fundamentals, eventually I think people will reach what you are discussing about this this place of flow.
Bro, I love it.
Where it just happens natural. Because when I think about my life now compared to my life 20 years ago before I even started meditation, I was just a ball of anxiety and thoughts, just trying to figure everything out. But now all that needs to happen is get up, meditate, make breakfast, get to work. You know, things just, as you say, they flow. They just happen. Even when things go wrong, all right, well, we'll respond to that however we can and we'll see what happens. But the other thing that you mentioned, early on, you talked about how your initial motivation, or a lot of people's motivations, even mine, getting into meditation is kind of to escape pain or to deal with pain, right?
Right.
Well, it's been described to me one time in a very, what I thought, interesting way, the ideas of the gunas, tamas, rajas, and sattva. And, you know, in the Yoga Sutras, part of the goal is to get a person to the sattvic kind of living state, which is the flow state, such that they can eventually transcend that too. But before we get to transcendence, sattva needs to be kind of cultivated. And I'm trying to tie all this together, so bear with me. With the tamasic state, it was described to me that when a person is acting out of tamas, it's because some problem is there and needs to be dealt with right now. So, for example, your house is burning down. The tamasic reaction is to get up and run out. You know, it's not this idea of, oh, you're dark and you're heavy and you're bad. It's, you know, you're in pain, so you need to do something to get out of pain. That's like a tamasic motivation.
Right.
And then a rajasic motivation was described to me. Rajas was described to me as being like a mist. And a rajasic motivation is, I have a choice.
Right.
And the mist is the false idea that you are an individual who's acting on its own behalf. So when a person starts meditation, they do it to get out of pain, tamasic motivation, no problem. It's still getting them into meditation. But then they move into the stage where there's not a lot of pain, but what do they do now? Oh, I want to be self-realized because I want to better myself. I want to choose to be something greater. So that's like a rajasic motivation of making yourself better. And then sattva, that's where we get into the Bhagavad Gita and the idea of, you know, the yogi is entitled to action only, not the fruits of their action. So the yogi then meditates or lives its life in a healthy way just because that is the appropriate natural thing to do, not because it wants something, not because it wants to escape from something, just because then it is in that state of flow where the sattvic inspiration happens. And that doesn't have to be limited to, my inspiration is simply, I'm going to sit here and meditate. It could be, hey, my inspiration is to go start a business. I'm not doing it because I want to improve the world. I'm not doing it because I want to be better. It's just because that is the natural inspiration of flow of where my life is going right now. You see?
Yes.
So anyway, everything you described about music and it all just kind of came together.
No, I'm loving it. I like the analogy of the music a lot. We always tell our students in our Vinyasa yoga trainings that because we have a very specific sequence of asanas or postures that we teach, and they have to teach a class at the end of the course in order to pass and get their diploma and certification and all that. And invariably, every group that we have, someone tries to start playing jazz in their class.
Right.
And we always have to correct them and say, look, you know, you're learning the melody right now, and mm-hmm. you need to focus on the melody. You have to learn the melody before you can play jazz.
Right.
And so maybe that melody is reading the sacred texts often and studying from a teacher, you know, who is enlightened or at least semi-enlightened.
Right.
And so maybe that's melody that we have to learn before we get into that flow state and we can just start playing jazz and get the, mm-hmm. the mind totally out of the way. So I really love that. And also, yeah, you know, you talked about, and I think maybe we've talked about this before or maybe someone else, but you know, a lot of the more sort of deeper experiences that I've had during meditation happened actually sort of earlier on, the first few years I meditated. Now I just meditate because it just feels like the right thing to do.
Right.
Not because I'm seeking after some great revelation, realization, or anything like that. It's just, and I talked to Mr. Davis about this too, and he said, yeah, you know, in the same way, I continue to meditate because it just seems like the appropriate thing for me to do.
Right. Yes. Well, that reminded me of an experience with Mr. Davis too. And I remember it was, I don't know when it was, but I remember I walked in one day to visit with him and we sat down and, you know, he was talking and sharing his stories and he got quiet a minute. And then I said, you know, the more I do this, you know, I look around and I just sort of have this feeling like this is it. Mm. He looked around, he said, yep, pretty much.
Yes. I love it. Yeah. Pretty much it.
Yeah. So anyway. All right. Well, I'm looking over, you know, some of these other sutras that we had picked out or you had picked out to discuss. And I think that they might take us into a few more hours worth of discussion, so we might need to save those for another time.
Super.
Yeah, but I think we ended on a wonderful note to conclude on. So
absolutely.
I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and, you know, share your experience and share, you know, your thoughts on these sutras. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Anytime. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
This episode of the Kriya Yoga Podcast was made possible by donations from Kriya Yoga Apprenticeship students and supporters of our Patreon community at www.patreon.com/KriyaYoga.